Thank you. We're coming to you from the Providence Athenaeum. This is Policy and Pino. I'm Ian Donis, joined by Scott McKay, Wendy Schiller, and Brandon Bell. Before we move on, let's get a brief observation from Scott McKay on whether Hillary Clinton will be thrown out of the presidential race by some sort of legal charge before November.
I think I agree with Brandon on this one, that it's probably not going to happen. However, let's look back at Watergate. Now, if there's sufficient evidence and the FBI finds this and the administration declines to go forward, I'll tell you, there's about 8 million Woodward and Bernsteins in Washington who'd love to find a deep throat in the FBI that would come forward and talk about the evidence that they had against Secretary Clinton. So I wouldn't shut the door yet. However, I do think that it's very unlikely, given what's happened and given the fact that Colin Powell, Condi Rice, that other people had these private servers, I'm not sure this is an indictable federal crime.
Now, Donald Trump has not been the only big surprise of the 2016 campaign season. Bernie Sanders has run much stronger than most political observers anticipated. He came very close to beating Hillary Clinton in neighboring Massachusetts. And if you look at the working class towns outside the Boston suburbs, he really cleaned up everywhere except for Worcester and New Bedford. Now, I think it's pretty likely that Hillary Clinton will be the Democratic presidential nominee. Scott McKay, you know Bernie Sanders from your many years as a political reporter in Vermont. What happens to the Bernie Sanders political movement? Are those people going to stay home in November, or will they coalesce behind the Democratic nominee?
Well, the Clinton campaign has to make sure they do not stay home. They have to treat Sanders well at the convention, give him a primetime speaking position, take care of his people, give him a jet so he can go around the country and hold some rallies and try to get this part of the base out. Because what's happened is he's captured some of the populist anger on the left that we see Trump with on the right. A lot of the Occupy Wall Street movement, some of these people, the people who felt left behind. I was talking to a union leader here locally who I know, who sent a bunch of his members up to New Hampshire to campaign for Hillary, and he brought them down to the hot club after to have a beer, and we were chatting. And the funny thing was, is the leaders of the union were all very strong for Hillary Clinton, but boy, the membership said, I like what Bernie Sanders is saying. He's really laying it out on the line.
State Republican Chairman Brandon Bell, what do you think becomes of Bernie Sanders' movement if, as expected, he is not the Democratic nominee?
So they have three choices. They could vote for Hillary Clinton, they could vote for the Republican, or they could stay home. The chances of them voting for Donald Trump are 0.000. The chances of voting for Ted Cruz are 0.0001, and maybe they'll vote for Kasich, but I'm not so sure about that. So I think that I love some of these young people that support Sanders come out and vote for our candidate, but the belief systems are just not the same, and I don't see it. But it's amazing how much he's attracting. And what I was just saying to the professor was that, you know, at least he's honest, or he projects honesty. I don't know how he gives away half this stuff. Only Santa gives away stuff for free when I grew up, but you know, he's given a lot of stuff away, but at least he says what he wants to do.
Brown University political science professor Wendy Schiller, is Brandon Bell's criticism correct that Sanders is campaigning more on message than fleshed out ideas? And what do you say happens to his movement?
No, I mean, I think that it's been a very good thing for the Democratic Party to have Bernie Sanders in. I think it has brought in a lot of people, both young people and also older people who've been disaffected. I think the fact that the Obama administration did nothing to prosecute anybody from quote-unquote Wall Street, but particularly the mortgage securities industry, the subprime loan lending industry, nothing. Nobody got convicted. There's some insider trading, but generally, I think there's a general disillusionment with the Obama administration, and Hillary Clinton has, for good political reason, tied herself very closely to Obama. And Bernie Sanders captures everybody else who says, wait a minute, we're Democrats. Why didn't we go after the bad guys? And they never did. So I think he struck a chord. I think that all the polls now are showing that there'll be unification or reunification, as there was with Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. But the question is, will Bernie Sanders campaign for Hillary Clinton? I just don't know the answer to that.
I think he probably will. He's always been a pragmatic person. Even when he got elected as an independent on a Democratic Socialist line as mayor of Burlington, he frosted everybody on the left back in 1984 by going out and campaigning and working hard for Walter Mondale. He was running around calling, He used to call them Demikins and Republicrats. Not a dime's. He sounded like George Wallace sometimes. Not a dime's worth of difference between those two major parties. But when the national priorities came, and of course, as a mayor of the largest city in Vermont, very small place, 40,000 people, he realized that the urban programs and those kind of programs that Democrats need would have been a lot better to have Mondale in there than Reagan.
Let's go back to Wendy Schiller here. Professor, you mentioned the high degree of political disillusionment. We know that voters don't like hyper-partisanship in Washington, yet there seems to be no end to it in sight. The latest evidence is how the Republican-controlled Senate doesn't even want to vote on President Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland to the U.S. Supreme Court. Is this shaping up as a political victory for President Obama?
Well, I'm not sure it's a victory because I don't know that he'll get his nominee confirmed. However, if you have run for 6 years on shutting the government down and making sure the federal government doesn't work in order to shrink it, and then you still refuse to give... I mean, look, the Democrats defeated Robert Bork. They had hearings on him, and they voted against him. So, and the Republicans have said no to their own president's nominee. The first one of the first nominees for George W. Bush was denied by the Senate, but not in hearings. So I think this is a big mistake on the Republicans' part. Here's why. You're feeding the Trump machine. If you're the establishment Republican Party and you do not want him to be at the head of the ticket or to be president of the United States, the last thing you do is give another piece of evidence to voters that the federal government doesn't work.
Brandon Bell, are your peers in Washington feeding the Trump machine by not agreeing to a vote on the president's Supreme Court nominee?
the professor brought up Robert Bork. Look at Clarence Thomas and what happened there. You know, what impacts did those choices have on elections? Not much. A lot of people don't even know who the members of our Supreme Court are. I think more people here might know who the Supreme Court is on the seventh floor across the street than they do in the United States Supreme Court. But for unless they step aside in disgrace, and that doesn't happen too often in the United States Supreme Court. I don't think I would challenge Brown University to do a poll on name identification of Merrick Garland and what impact it'll have. I don't think it'll have much impact.
I think the Supreme Court matters, and all you have to look at is Gore v. Bush, Citizens United. These have become big issues in this country, and I think in this election, given the long time between now and November, I think the Republicans should have played Muhammad Ali and gone through a little rope-a-dope, had some hearings, and voted the fella down and picked apart his record.
I never said the Supreme Court didn't matter. I meant in terms of elections.
I think this election is going to be different.
I think only in the sense if you connect the dots. You have to connect the failure, once again, of the Senate to do something, and it's controlled by the Republicans. So it's a sort of a loose connection, but I think you can connect the dots.
Let's pull back and take 1,000 feet up, look at the presidential race. Bernie Sanders is in his 70s. Hillary Clinton's making her second run for the presidency. Donald Trump's been on the public scene for a long time. No disrespect to any of these candidates for their age or their presentation in public life, but the point is none of these people is actually a fresh face in politics. What does that tell us, Scott McKay?
Well, it tells me a couple of things. One is the former way we used to finance presidential elections. You had to build from the bottom up. We had a system of federal financing where you had to get like $250 donations from 500 people in each state to qualify. Now, if you know two billionaire hedge fund guys, you can put on a campaign. You can buy television from Iowa to California to New York. It's changed an awful lot. The other thing on the Democratic side, I think what changed everything was the reluctance of Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren to get into this race. I think Hillary Clinton would have a much tougher time were it not this 74-year-old socialist with the funny hair out there, you know, lecturing us every day. I think that she would have made a dramatic difference on the Democratic side.
Wendy Schiller, as Scott said, money is the mother's milk of politics, but we saw how Jeb Bush had as much money or more than anyone, and he really flamed out. So what do you make of this unusual presidential field this year?
Well, I mean, I think in terms of age, I think, you know, thankfully there are so many advances in aging that what we used to think was really old, Ronald Reagan being elected, is not so old anymore. I think that's sort of the simple fact. But I also think in times of uncertainty, we've just come out of, or maybe not quite out of, a great recession. The world is an insecure place. The world is a scary terrorist-laden place, people are fearful. And when they're fearful, they look for experience. And I think that's what we saw or we're seeing in the Republican presidential nomination and certainly with the Democratic. And I think this would have been an Achilles heel for Elizabeth Warren. I disagree with my colleague. I think, yes, she would have mounted a challenge on some levels. But I think national security and foreign policy for Hillary Clinton and years of experience doing multiple things in office, I think, would have been a counterweight to Elizabeth Warren.
You know, a lot of her foreign policy initiatives have been utter failures.
It doesn't matter. When you're in the room with the president making cabinet-level decisions about national security, it's still an advantage.
Now, Brandon Bell, a lot of people, including myself, thought Marco Rubio was going to be the Republican nominee. What's your explanation for why things have gone off the map, so to speak, this year in presidential politics?
Well, I think that, look, Jeb was running at like 20% in May before Donald Trump made his announcement. Marco had a forward-looking message. He had the problem of being attacked by Bush's super PAC. His message was totally drowned out by Trump's tweets. Then Trump gets $2 billion worth of media, $2 billion worth of free media. Didn't cost him a dime for that media. So when you look at it, and then, of course, you look at Rubio's strategy, since that was the specific question that Ian asked, he got sunk by Jeb. He got sunk by Christie sunk the SS Rubio in the New Hampshire debate. We all know what happened there, because I think this would be a totally different race had his strategy of getting third in Iowa, second in New Hampshire, and first in South Carolina, had that worked. So I think at the end of the day, Kasich and Bush would have gotten out, and things would be completely different as far as trajectory goes. So listen, everybody pays attention to what Trump says, and that's part of the problem for some of the other candidates.
I'd like to return on a related note to the plight of the middle class. We know the percentage of middle class Americans is shrinking, and that's a underpinning for much of what's happening in the presidential race. Wendy Schiller, who is better prepared, Democrats or Republicans, to help the middle class in this presidential election, and why?
Well, I think in terms of positioning your platform, the Democratic Party has, since essentially FDR, argued that the government can be there for people who cannot help themselves. The government can also provide support for things like education, starting with the GI Bill and then moving forward. And I think that when you think the government can help people to advance their own interests, particularly economic mobility, I think you're going to win in a contest that surrounds people's economic status. And the Republicans have always said, if you get the government out of the way, things will equalize. And so I think people don't think that's true anymore, although I do also think there's less confidence in the solution that government can solve the problem. But at least when you start from that discussion point, I think you have an edge in this kind of climate.
Scott McKay, Ronald Reagan used to say the scariest words for anyone opening their front door was, "We're from the government and we're here to help." Was he right? Is big government the wrong answer for helping the middle class?
Well, actually, Ronald Reagan said an awful lot of things that appeal to the right, but he didn't do hardly anything to change the size of the government. And in fact, he worked very closely with Tip O'Neill to save Social Security after he got pasted in the 1982 elections in the House. And I think Reagan said a lot of things to the abortion people, all these right-wing folks. But even as governor of California, he was basically governed as a moderate. And I think he did change the tenor of American politics. But I go back before, because Reaganism really starts in 1964 with Goldwater. And that campaign really predated, I think, Reagan. And now we still have some of the strains of Goldwaterism in it. And I won't say the Republican Party is going to die a death, because everybody said that after Goldwater, and 4 years later, the Democratic Party had its own nervous breakdown at the Chicago convention, and Richard Nixon, who basically was a moderate, he had a southern strategy, but he governed as a moderate, basically, becomes president.
State Republican Chairman Brandon Bell, I suspect you might want to respond to some of what Scott said and give us your view on why I suspect, I imagine you'll predict Republicans can do more for the middle class. Tell us why.
Going back to Scott's point about Goldwater, if you think about the conservative movement, there was no way Goldwater was going to win after Kennedy was just assassinated. I mean, LBJ had that thing. I don't know what the electoral votes were, but it must have been a landslide. I'm sure it was. But he created the conservative movement. And so if you look back to some of the Reagan policy, of which the conservative movement was forwarded. I still believe that reducing regulation and reducing taxation is an effective plan to grow the middle class. Again, I think a Republican is better suited to do that. I don't think Bernie
Why?
Sanders. For all the reasons that Scott did not say.
Well, and would you care to enumerate some of those?
Yeah, well, we do need to keep government out of our bedrooms, out of our pockets, out of our lives. We need constitutional conservatism, and I believe that if you look at it from the perspective of why this country is so exceptional, it's because we have that document, because we have the Constitution, because we don't have the king and the subjects, because government works for us. That's the way it's supposed to work, and that's the way, unfortunately, we've moved away from that over the last 7.5 years.
Brandon Bell, if it's Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump in November, who's going to win?
Pass.
Come on.
I would say that Donald Trump has a lot of work to do if he becomes the Republican Party's nominee.
Would you vote for – if he is the nominee, will you vote for him?
Absolutely, 100%. I will vote for Donald Trump if he's the nominee.
Wendy Schiller, what do you say about how these two political figures line up in November potentially?
Well, again, head-to-head polls are not very indicative of what's really going to happen, but – what you want to look at, if you want to figure out who's going to win this election, I think we go back to 2012 and 2008. Look at the swing states, identified: North Carolina, Wisconsin, Nevada, Colorado, Florida, New Hampshire, Ohio, just to name a few. Start looking at those head-to-head polls in July and figure out whether they change. And if they don't change much, which is exactly what happened with Romney and Obama in 2012, they never really changed from July to November, and they predicted Obama's ratio of winning some of those states very accurately. That's what you want to look at if you want to figure out whether Hillary Clinton, theoretically, if she's the nominee, defeats Donald Trump.
And the last word on that question to Scott McKay.
Yeah, the key is going to come down to whether Trump can break up the Democratic coalition that won twice for Obama. That's bicoastal, the upper Great Lakes states, which have become the foundation of the blue states. And what's really happened here is that the pillar of the Republican Party, the central pillar of the party, is now the South and the old Confederacy. Just quickly, in 1960 in the House, Republicans had 174 seats. And they had 178 in 2008, pretty much the same. But in 1960, 35 of those Republicans represented districts in New York and New England, while only 8 were from the 11 states of the old Confederacy. Now, among the 2008 Republican House members, only 3 came from New England and New York, 73 from the old Confederacy. And even in the last election in 2014, a very good year for Republicans nearly everywhere, the balance didn't change much. Republicans from former Confederate states now outnumber those from New York and New England by 9-1. And I think that's part of Chairman Bell's problem with getting Republicans elected statewide in Rhode Island, because a lot of young people in particular see the National Republican Party and they don't think a lot of it.
What are the chances Scott McKay would have a crib sheet outlining Republican representation in the U.S. House in 1960?
Well, Democrat, too.
There you go. We are fair and balanced. And we are going to take a break. Coming up, a look at whether Republicans will be able to increase their representation in the Rhode Island General Assembly. I'm Ian Donis. You're listening to Policy and Pino on Rhode Island Public Radio. And we're recording in front of a live audience here at the Providence Athenaeum. Stay with us.